reading from the Yoga Sutras, chapter 1, text 2. Yoga Chitta Vritti Nirodha. Om Jnana Timarandasya Jnananjana Salakaya Chakshurunmilitam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. Sri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Dapitam Yena Bhutale Sayam Rupakadamayam Vidati Sapadantikam Vansha Kalpa Tarubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Vayubhacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namah. Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasade Gaur Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. That's not on now, is it? It's the phone. No, okay. Oh, that's okay. I thought that was yours. Okay. It's, okay. So, greetings from Papano Beach. You know my book here, I have some audience, Greetings from Vrindavan. That's how it started. You know, kind of to market my classes, you had to have a catchphrase. So it was greeting, and I would travel, so it was greetings from Vrindavan or greetings from New York. So this is greetings from Pompano Beach, and I'm with my brother Javi Padua, his wife, we've been treated to a wonderful concert today. He's a wonderful musician. And some of you know Marite. And Marite sponsors my trip here. And if Kishori Radha is listening, your younger brother Kevin is here, and he's been very good. Okay. So, Hare Krishna. Everybody should mute their phone, but sometimes people forget. Just concentrate now, star 6. It's muted, then we can't hear you. So, so we've been discussing this subject, and I'm actually developing the method for discussing it, because it's something new, because I generally discuss, I've been doing this for 3.5 years. The people that I'm also going to talk a little bit to my audience today, it will also be relevant. But I've been doing this for 3.5 years, twice a week. And I've gone through so many books. But this is the first time I've gone to a book that's a little bit on the edge of our tradition. Even though you'd be very surprised that when Prabhupada came to New York in 1965, a book that he brought is called Hindu Philosophy by Chatterjee and Dutt. And it's one of the books I used to prepare for this course. And Prabhupada brought that book simply as a reference to study yoga, the yoga philosophy. It's mentioned in Prabhupada's folio. He actually had that book, and he was quoting it in 1965. So Prabhupada also understood that this philosophy of yoga, even back then, was prevalent. And he himself wanted a frame of reference. It means he didn't, not that he didn't understand the subject, because it's in the Bhagavatam, it's in the Bhagavad Gita, but he wanted the classic frame of reference to as a communicator of Indian thought. So in my own teaching of it in these last few days, I'm kind of developing the method of how to share this. And I think it's more going to be like almost like classical, a little bit more like classical Indian philosophy, more than there's a term called vada, which is a discussion of the subject, and you return to it, and you refine it, and you discuss it from different angles. And I really think this particular type of subject will be more in that mode. And because this particular verse has the longest commentary. I'm using a addition to actually prepare the class that has six commentaries. And the main commentary is by Vyas. Of course, they're not sure. They can't say it's not the Vyas, Veda Vyas, but they're not sure it is. But he's the main commentator, and everything else follows in his line. And sometimes there'll be some terminology, especially today, which we'll discuss. And it's understood also that don't worry if you don't pick it up the first time, because even in Bhagavad Gita, if you study Bhagavad Gita, it's even known with, I remember when I went to Burijan's class, and one student in the second chapter, when they discussed these subjects, even Prabhupada, I think, called the second chapter Sankhya Yoga, which is the basis of the metaphysics of studying yoga. I remember one person was trying to understand this point, how work can be spiritual. That's one of the basic points of the Bhagavad Gita, that what makes something spiritual is not the activity, but the consciousness in which it's done. And therefore, it's in the setting of a war, not to explain a type of jihad, but to bring a point in a context that will force you to understand that point. If you're just explaining that spiritual life is the consciousness and not the activity, and you just try to explain it in terms of the temple, people may not get it. But explain it in terms of someone who's going outside with a briefcase and working every day. Somehow there's a reverberation of the, you know, maybe my phone is not so good here. It's not a good connection here. No, because I'm getting a reverberation. I'm wondering if you have another phone, it may be better. And you have something like a... I think I'll try it on that. Are you hearing me? I'm hearing a reverberation. How are we doing?
Maharaj, we can hear you. There's an echo for us, too.
There is an echo for you also?
Is it possible, Marge, that someone in the room with you who's listening on speakerphone might have a phone on also? Because usually there's an echo when there's a phone.
Are you sure there's no one in the room that has a speakerphone on? Oh, okay. But anyway, I'm going to do it from another phone.
Another phone?
Okay. One second. Wait right there. I'll be right with you. Hare Krishna? Can you hear me?
Yes, Marsh.
Still, the echo is still there somehow.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible someone doesn't have a phone muted or something.
No, it's just a connection. Anyway, we're going to plow away through it. We've done this before. Okay? So, and part of that discussion, you know, to really understand it deeply, is that I'm taking questions. So these are some questions that were brought up. In my last class, I defined chitta, because it's yoga, chitta, vritti, nirodha, that yoga is restraint of the changing states of the mind, of the thoughts of the mind. And chitta was defined as mind. But I defined it as mind broader than just... the mind in that context means different functions of thought, functions of emotions and feelings, functions of discrimination, functions of self-identity, and all together that's called the mind. There's also a Sanskrit word that is called manas, which refers to the function of the mind that deals with
recognition of sensory impulse and ascribing some feelings or sentiments to it. But when we say chitta, I'm going to use the term chitta or the mind to deal with the whole sum total of the of thoughts, which includes feelings and self-identity, etc. So Hari Kirtan asked the question that I made the point when I quoted to help people understand what yoga is, that yoga is this cleaning of the mind that reveals the soul, that it's similar in our tradition to the first verse of the Shikshastakam where it says Chaito Dharpanam Marjanam. That one effect of mantra meditation is Chaito Dharpanam Marjanam. It cleans the mirror of the mind. Right? Hari Kirtan glossed the word Chaita and in Prabhupada's folio, and it's exclusively defined as the heart. That he wanted to know if this is the same as chitta. I called up Pandaji, Prabhupada's Sanskrit pandit today, and he said it's the same exact root word. So you know, and he says, you know, this chaitana, chit means to think, to consider, to, but you know, the heart. It's not just that when you say the heart. It's not just talking about a physical vessel. It's talking about the functions of the heart, thought. It's talking about the consciousness. So basically, it is the same word. It's not just that Prabhupada used somehow the word the heart to refer, basically, I think, that was his English word for aware consciousness, basically. You know, to change the heart. What does to change the heart mean? It changes the way you consider things. It changes the way you think about things. It changes your self-identity. When he says changing the heart, Prabhupada was talking about the same function. Just in his English translation, he thought that he would use that. But chitta basically means the mind. And I did study a little philosophy in college. I did. I'd be ashamed to say I had a degree in it. It's true, but I didn't really study it very thoroughly. But I do know that was the first thing you understood. You talk about the mind, and you're basically talking about the consciousness. It's not just up in your head. It's what pervades your whole body, basically, your thought processes, your feelings, your sensations. Same thing with the heart. And then I got a question from Mahamuni, and he said, can you define more specifically the five states of the mind? Because one thing that was described, and one thing we're going to have to go over, and I said it's going to probably take a few classes to disperse, gives a lot of terminology to help us understand the, because yoga means to control the mind. So there's a basis of understanding how the mind functions. It helps you understand how the mind becomes controlled. Everything has a utility. And when you understand how something works, you can use it better. So it's a sense like that. Because as I mentioned before, yoga is not necessarily too much a theological conception. It's a psychosomatic process, how the mind works. And therefore, it's something that's found practically in all schools of thought. So he described as five states of mind. And the reason why five states of mind are described, because yoga actually refers to the states of mind. Yoga in this particular thing means a very restrained, controlled mind. And when you have that level of controlled mind, it destroys mental afflictions. And when the mental afflictions become destroyed, then one's ability to discriminate and see carefully becomes pronounced, and therefore he can discriminate the self from the non-self. And all suffering is based on identifying the non-self, or the mind and the body as the self, and therefore experiencing it. And even in some of the definitions of yoga that's given, you know, in different schools of thought, one of the definitions of yoga is given, you know, relief from suffering, because that's what it does. when you actually can meditate and focus the mind and suppress the other vrittis or thoughts, you come to a platform where you can become free from suffering. So some define it as evenness of the mind, restraint of the mind, etc. But it's basically the same thing that's being discussed. Somehow or other, managing your life, living your life, and being able to come to a point where you can restrain the impulse of thoughts and concentrate. It's a mechanical process, basically, that purifies the mind. And therefore, again, we discussed, when we discussed what is yoga, it's really referring to that point of dispassion, a very high state of meditation. And therefore, there's Ashtanga yoga, but really, the Ashtanga yoga, it really means that there's five processes or practices that you get to the point where you get to yoga. And that's yam, which means moral restraint, how you deal with other things, because it's all a degree of concentration. So the first level of concentration is controlling your mind in relationship to others. Then there's yam niyam, moral observances, how you relate to the mind in relationship to your own practice and moral behavior. Then asana, and then pranayama. Then comes yoga. So he wants to describe that this is a classical five steps of five states of the mind, and the mind will always be in one of these five states. You have to come to the higher states for yoga. And another interesting thing, because I got this from that Hindu philosophy book that Prabhupada brought to America. And one interesting thing with that is, in this description, it also relates the states of the mind to the modes of nature that they're in. Which is also why, when you want to understand yoga and philosophy, you have to have, this is a book about yoga philosophy, you have to understand how the modes work. And in the commentary on this verse, yoga, chitta vritti nirodha, that yoga means, nirodha, the cessation, chitta vritti, of the fluctuations of thoughts of the mind. That's why he also, you have to have a basis for understanding the gunas, because they're the subtle underpinnings of all matter, and how they are composed will determine the nature of the feelings and consciousness you'll have. And yoga is to come to a purified consciousness. So that process of concentrating the mind is also bringing you to a more purified state of consciousness. So these are the five states. The lowest state is mudha, or forgetful. It's when there's an excess of tamagun, ignorance. There's a state of mind, and the symptoms of that is delusion, sleep, inactivity, inertia. Wait, I got so much. Okay. I got some. Someone emailed me something. The suggestion is that I can put the whole conference in a. I can mute everybody else. I'm giving voluntarily. And if someone doesn't mute the phone, then it may cause that echo. That's what the person's saying. But I also experience that it's usually due to like a bad connection. And but here it is. So one is forgetful, and therefore its symptom is vice, because there's no discrimination, and it manifests in how you treat yourself and how you treat your others. You're completely unrestrained. So that's a mudha. Then there's chitta, wandering, restless. The mind is now. It's not just tamas. It has or ignorance. It has passion. And it's attracted to the object of senses, and you know, but it's a little bit of a higher state. Then there's another state called ikshipta, distracted. And the mind becomes is free from ignorance. It has some passion, and it has the capacity to understand things, and it makes for virtue and knowledge. But it's still not yoga because it becomes distracted. This concept of yoga is when the mind becomes fixed. It's still wandering. It is still some passion. Even though ignorance, the mind is more active and it's subduing that. He describes extensively how you live your life and how you meditate in the world. You can get to that. Okay. I'll just have to say it again. Star 6, mute your phone. If I can hear people. My God, I can hear people there. Please mute your phone. Star 6, I can hear some children talking. Okay, Rutty, if you're on, we're going to have to do it the other way, where I have control of the mute. It's frustrating sometimes, and people become, for some person will just be cooking in the kitchen, and then it'll be distracted. Okay, after class, right? Okay, review of this text from the last class. And the first verse of the Yoga Sutras we did was, I think, Atha Yoga Shastanam. But now we'll discuss yoga. And it introduced the subject matter of the text. It didn't define yoga. But it said now, it's very significant, now it's significant that we're going to discuss this particular subject. It usually indicates the beginning of a particular sutra. We describe what sutra means, an aphorism, how things would be learned by memory. So it was necessary for the great schools of thought to codify it in words. And it was understood that people of that day had the frame of reference to understand it. But, you know, then the commentaries unpack the meaning. But it just basically, the first verse just introduced the subject matter. That'll be a discussion of yoga. It's significant. And the second verse proceeded to define what yoga is. And this is what is yoga? The cessation of the fluctuations in the mind. And then there was a discussion, I'm still going over the last class, that in Sankhya, there was a need to understand Sankhya and yoga metaphysics to understand how yoga works. Maybe, can this be, does this have a speaker on this? Yeah. It's Mahamuni?
It's Mahamuni?
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 Mahamuni, are you there?
Maharaj?
Yeah. I just want to, the point that was made is that to understand Sankhya, the yoga philosophy, you have to understand Sankhya. What's the difference between Sankhya and yoga? And why do you think, according to your studies, why one needs to understand Sankhya as a foundation for yoga philosophy?
I the relationship between the two, they're really, really old terms that go back to, like, you know, some of the oldest texts in India. Generally, my understanding is that a simple way to distinguish between the two is that Sankhya is that part of yoga which focuses on categorizing reality, and yoga is that part that has to do with, as you've often said, psychophysical discipline. And so my impression is that the real power of Sankhya is that when we learn to see the things which are external to us as actually being external to us, learn that philosophy and deeply internalize it, then we can start to recognize tendencies that we used to think were us, but now we can see them as alien forces, so to speak. So it's something like in psychotherapy or something, somebody may start to learn that a certain habit they have dominated them for a very long time. Really them, and they start to see it as something external to them and something which they can disidentify with. So that's my understanding of the role of Sankhya, is that it gives us a kind of picture of reality that we can do yoga within, but that picture is really particularly meant to teach us what isn't us. We learn to distinguish between our actual self and that. So I don't, did that help, or should we...
That helps, but there's one other thing. Why do they think it's a necessity to understand Genesis? You know, why you have to understand Purusha Prakriti, what's Buddhi, what's Manas, why? As a foundation for your understanding yoga.
Ryan?
That wasn't me. Somebody else? Does someone else have something to say? Or did I?
Oh, good. Mooney.
Oh, okay. I guess, Maharaj, the basic idea is just that without some basic map, it's very hard to practice anything. And I don't know, I mean, you know, so for example, if you don't have the basic between Purusha and Prakriti down, then while undergoing contemplation, it's very hard to understand whether you've uncovered the self or not, because you may just uncover more subtle levels of Prakriti. And so the practice has to be guided by a fairly clear notion of what reality is. If not, I mean, you know, like any practice needs to be guided by a basic map. If not, then it's hard to understand the deeper experiences that come up as one undergoes deeper forms of meditation. It's hard to understand how they're legitimate or not, or whether they're signs of advancement, or whether they're very confused.
Hey, thank you, Mooney.
Okay.
Sorry, did I press this button again? All right, Krishna, you can hear me? Yeah, okay. So I just want to explain some basic foundational points. The first basis is the ultimate reality is perceived as a product of two distinct categories, Prakriti, or material nature, and Purusha, pure awareness of the soul. That's the basis of Sankhya. And and when there's a... Okay. 1 second. It's a little bit. Okay, that's it. All right, let me... So Purusha and Prakriti and the cause of suffering is a lack of discrimination between them. And therefore, freedom from suffering comes when there's distinction between the two, because it's the identification of the self or the soul with the non-self. And the suffering is happening in the mind and the body, which is not the self, and because you identify with you suffer. And it's not just an intellectual thing that frees you from suffering, you actually have to realize it. And that's the process of yoga. I would say also the process of philosophy is you understand what the difference is. Yoga is more the practice that actually acts on that platform. You realize that you're not the mind and the practice, and you stop, you restrain those impulses and start to stop identifying. And you actually realize that you're not the self. And therefore, us today, because I'm getting such a thing, but yeah, I'm going to plow through it anyway. I'm usually doing just take a few deep breaths and just hear comfortably. And therefore, what yoga means is the process. All right, Krishna, this is better?
Yeah. I apologize for interrupting, but you know, a certain friend of ours in Mutuchin right now on the line.
Yeah.
I don't embarrass anybody, but
yeah.
If Gail could mute his phone, it would be great.
You know it, sir?
I think I heard her twice.
Somebody in the kitchen.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Loud and clear, my love.
Okay, all right. All right. Thanks anyway, Mohammed.
Gail? You go. Terrible.
Gail, did you get caught?
Yes.
Was your phone muted?
Nope. Well, apparently not, even though I pressed star 6. Okay, goodbye.
Go up now.
They caught the culprit.
Okay. Is that better?
Fantastic.
Okay. Okay. It's hard to concentrate today, but I'm gonna. So, I have to find my train of thought is. So just understand. So what is the nature of yoga? So I just wanted to explain a few different ways in which you can see it. When one concentrates and he suppresses the mental impulses, then which are born of passion and ignorance, the mind comes to sattva. And sattva literally means the nature of being. It's the pure state of the mind. And the mind, it's an apparatus which is used. So when the apparatus is kind of polished, or the apparatus is in its most pure workable state of sattva, then what happens is it manifests qualities of discrimination, and therefore the distinction and the soul of the distinction between the Purusha and Prakriti, or the soul and matter, becomes revealed when the mind is not distracted. So it's a mechanical process. The impulses are restricted, which are born of passion and ignorance. You bring the mind to its pure state. And when it comes to its pure state, it manifests of sattva, it has the mind is more discriminating, and it can make distinctions. And we all have that experience, not all, but those people who know what the modes are, you know, when it's goodness, there's more discrimination. In the early morning, when the hot time of the day has the influence of sattva or discrimination, you can discriminate. Probably, if you write music in the early morning, you know what I'm saying? It probably you can hear the sounds more clearly. You can think more clearly what they are. So in the same way, if there's a process to bring the mind to goodness, and the most powerful psychosomatic process is this concentration. What the concentration does, basically it allows you to suppress all the other thoughts. And those of us, we all here do mantra meditation, we have the same thing. When we actually have a good meditation, we went to those japa retreats, when you actually have a good meditation, I'm not talking about the transcendental effect of chanting, I'm talking about the mechanical effect of chanting. when you actually spend time, just the mechanical of suppressing those thoughts, and then the mind comes to its pure state. Because the passion and ignorance is, because that's what causes the rapid fluctuations of the mind. It's the passion. So it comes to sattva, and two factors are there. It becomes discriminating, and the nature of sattva is becomes lucid or luminous. And it's described, that's chaito dharpana marginam. It's like the mind when it has dust, when it looks into the mirror, your reflection looks dusty. Your reflection is not dusty, but because of the nature of the apparatus by which you are viewing yourself, your image becomes distorted. When you look at your reflection in a sword, which has an elongated shape, then your image may be distorted. And if you're not aware that your image is not what's in the sword, but that it's being distorted, then you will react according to it. So that's basically what the process of yoga mechanically does. I'm just going to describe, today it was a little bit difficult in ways, but I've got a good advice, and I'm not going to listen. I'm just going to speak, so it's going to be easy. See, you get good advice here. Thank you. Again, to yoga deals with realizing the soul through the use of the mind, especially Bodhi, because Bodhi has the platform to discriminate. And the whole point is this discrimination. Not just this discrimination intellectually, but this, as Mahamuni is explaining, when you have the distinction and you know what to do and what not to do, and you can neglect the things that are not the self, the impulses, and you can actually concentrate, then you can actually realize the difference. So the different functions of thought is the Bodhi, is the manas, the mind, or the manas, the Bodhi, the intelligence, or the ahankara. So basically the way it works is that the sense, you get sensory perception, and then when you get the sensory perception, it kind of identifies it and describes feelings. So it's basically called impulsive reflection. But then there's a deeper reflection, and that's called Bodhi. And the deeper reflection is the analysis by which you can make decisions, and it becomes like a finer apparatus. There's something here I'll read. It's determines, the Bodhi determines what is our duty or dharma in relation to the data it is receiving from the mind and senses, what to do about it, and how to respond or act. And what is the Bodhi? It's based on some higher authority or some knowledge. So you have an understanding based on shastra, based on some tradition, based on some proper experience on how to relate to the world, and how to relate to the, how to, first of all, how to identify properly what things are, and therefore how properly to respond to them. And this concept of dharma or duty, the science of relating to the world, is if you relate to the world properly, relating to the world properly is filtering or digesting the experiences of the world in a way in which the consciousness becomes elevated. So, when you act impulsively according to your previous imprint, It may be that way, or it may not be that way. But when you can relate to it appropriately and properly, according to some body of knowledge, and we do believe there's the Vedas, and the concept is when God creates the universe, along with the universe comes knowledge, and knowledge is the utility of everything. And the utility of everything also gives knowledge of how we relate to things properly. So the buddhi or the intelligence is reflective and it can discriminate, it can make judgment, ascertainment, will in the appropriate way. Because everything is based on the impressions that come in the consciousness. And if you have some experience or you approach something in the world, it'll come in through the senses. But the impression it makes in the consciousness can be filtered or guided through the intelligence. So the impression is based on a proper understanding of things. Just like someone could go through some difficulty or trauma, but through the intelligence, he'll understand his responsibility for that trauma in terms of his own karmic responsibilities. He'll understand also God in the world. And I was thinking of this point, that if you actually have proper perception of things, you see God. It's just like in the Bhagavatam, when the bull was being beaten by the low-class person, and then Marge Prickett came and asked the bull, who has done this? He wouldn't identify the perpetrator. Why? Because he was understanding God, that God is the cause. So he said, you are Dharma. That's what Dharma is. Dharma is actually to see God as the cause. So when you actually can relate to the world appropriately, and therefore accept the input that comes from the world, rather than impulsively, but filter it through the intelligence, which can see it for what it is, in relationship to God, then the impressions are elevating. And that's why people have mentors, that's why people have guides, that's why there's shastra, etc. Because how do you make sense of all of this? You know, what is it? And so the impressions will be digested. And I mentioned before, too, that's a child, why a child is so vulnerable, because she has no digestive faculty yet. The mother has to be very protective, because things will come in and impress, but they'll cause fear when the fear is due to your lack of understanding rather than what is. Just like the example is, again, you look in the mirror and the mirror is distorted, then you see an image. So the lady looks in the mirror and says, oh, I'm so heavy. Now she has to be so worried. But the problem is that the image was distorted. So the real thing of buddhi or intelligence is to put the right image in and have the right impression without fear to actually see God. And so everything can be. So this is basically what buddhi is. And we should also mention that the mind and the intelligence, although there's thinking and thought patterns and things that are going on, it's a material apparatus. It appears conscious, but consciousness in the soul, it's a material apparatus. And it would be described like, and the consciousness of the mind is sometimes described like this. It's described just as like, it's described that the nature of matter, gross matter, somehow it's so thick and tamasic that the consciousness really can't relate to it. So how we relate, this is the theory of perception, is the gross images, they make impressions. impressions in the consciousness. According to yoga, it would be in the booty. According to the Bhagavatam, the Bhagavatam, the Sankhya, the Bhagavatam, the chitta or the subconscious is a different thing. But it would make an impression in the booty, which is a kind of sheath close to the soul. And it would almost be like a movie. You know, you take a picture and the impression is on the reel and it's kind of translucent. What's the other word? And representational of something outside. It's translucent. And then when light goes through it, it becomes revealed. So the mind is like that. It kind of has images from the world. And those impressions are made in the conscious. And then the soul sees things through that. And the point is the more that it's in goodness, the more you get the right impressions. And the more you can actually see things properly. And eventually, the more you can see the soul. So really, this yoga process, when it deals with all these different functions, you know, the whole yoga process is to restrain the impulses that distort the consciousness. And eventually, it becomes a greater apparatus. And then eventually, when it comes to the platform of goodness, then the soul can see its own reflection, truly understand it, and make that, this is not me. This is something like that. I'll just make one more thing because we're coming towards the end, and somehow at the end, as always, the vrittis or the transformations of the phone in terms of the unmute phone that make it impossible for us to hear. Now they're pacified, and my true voice and intelligence and understanding is finally reflected in the thing. But so just the vrittis, these patterns of thought, and basically this apparatus is given to act not as a soul, but to act as something else, because the soul is a particle of consciousness. It's meant for the service of the supreme consciousness. It has a pure awareness. So the whole apparatus is working for the false conception of life. So the pure soul, he misidentifies with these thoughts, and he sees them as himself rather than an entity outside himself. So the yoga means to stop these fluctuations, and somehow when that's done, preventing the mind from being molded into these impressions and change, then it somehow becomes aware of itself. So that's basically okay. Not getting this everywhere. At 9 o'clock at night, wherever I am. Okay. Are there any questions? We got some points in there finally. Any questions?
Hare Volmarsh?
Yeah, Mooney.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, this is Gail.
The Mooney is not on, then you come, Gail. Okay.
Okay.
Mooney?
Maharaj, first of all, your inspiration, working through a difficult class, I can relate when factors aren't well to give a good class, so thank you for providing a lot of insight despite the challenges.
One second. I need to unmute the phone just so people can hear. Okay, good.
So, Marge, I have, if I may, a brief comment and then a question.
Please do.
You had brought up the question of the difference between the need for Sankhya within yoga. And something else that struck me after I muted the phone again was that Right now, like, we have a little Gita study that we do here in Austin, and we're reading the fourth chapter of the Gita. And in the famous verse that says, Tad Vidi Pranipatena, you know, that one should submit to a guru, the context there is that you can't do karma yoga unless you have this knowledge. And this, and as Bodhidharma Prabhu has said, knowledge which turns ordinary work into karma yoga. So what struck me was that when Ramanuja talks about the kind of knowledge you need to do karma yoga, he basically says it's the knowledge of the self as given earlier in the second chapter of the Gita. So again, I think that the idea is that genuine yoga requires an actual understanding of who we are, and we try to internalize that notion. And without a clear understanding of what we are, then we don't even have a goal in yoga. Anyway, I'm sorry, Marj. That just came to mind after we had that.
Okay. Good question.
So the question is, there's often the way that you've presented so far the manas, buddhi, and ahankara made it very clear that they're not the self. Last week, in particular, you often said that the mind is a material entity. This week, you said that the buddhi is just it's an apparatus. It's not sentient. So there's a part of me that wonders and maybe worries about the idea, are we, from the Vedantic perspective that we've inherited from Srila Prabhupada and our lineage, is there a little bit more of the self in the world than maybe the yoga school is allowing for? Does that make sense, my question, or should I?
Actually, it's very interesting because I just spoke to Pradyumna today. And he was quoting from some commentary that there's a chit manas, there's a chit buddhi, there's a chit identity. And there's a spiritual mind, there's a spiritual intelligence, etc. I don't know if your question was, is that some interaction into the world? That's another point that we'll have to discuss, that the... there's a way to access the internal potency to experience things beyond the material mind. And I think there's something as super soul experience also. And actually, Pradyumna was very nice. He was talking about you can chant from the lips, you can chant from the mind, but he said when you come to Shuddhanam, it's the Atma itself which is chanting. When you come to pure chanting, it's the Atma or the self itself. So I think in Gaudiya Vedanta, there's definitely an aspect that it's not just always, you know, just through this apparatus of the mind or intelligence, but you can come in contact in ways with the pure soul. And he said that he was quoting an Acharya, that the nine aspects, the nine items of pure devotional service can be manifestations of the Atma. You can be smarren as a manifestation of the Atma. There can be, he said when you perform pure devotional service, they become manifestations of the Atma. So there is some kind of interplay there. Does that make sense?
It does, and thank you very much. I've never heard things put like that. It really, it's great, thank you.
Okay. Unfortunately, today I really should wind up the class. It's getting late here, and there's people that have to go home, etc. But if anyone would like to say hello to us in Pompano Beach, we'd really appreciate it.
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Who's this?
It's Karunika in Christchurch, New Zealand.
Oh, Karunika. Christchurch, New Zealand. I'd like to congratulate you on I got a letter from Ariel inviting me to his wedding in Christchurch.
Are you going to come?
I'll try. Okay, thank you for coming on, Karunika. Thank you. Hare Krishna. Okay. Anybody else like to say Hare Krishna?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, please accept my humble obeisances.
Marite. Amia, she lives in New York City. Marite stayed with her for a while. Okay, Hare Krishna, thank you. Anybody else like to say Hare Krishna?
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Who
can you hear me?
Yes, who is this?
This is Rasigya.
No Rasigya?
Yeah.
Hi.
Okay.
So we talk. Bobby is offering his respects to you.
I'm offering them back.
Thank you, thank you.
Thank
okay.
You.
Okay. Anybody else like to say Hare Krishna? Okay. Anybody else like to say Hare Krishna? Okay, one more person?
One more person.
Okay, the next class we'll move on because these subjects will be discussed again and again. We'll do verses 3 and 4. Thank you all for coming to the class.